Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of the environment, health, and food. And each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your well-being, the well-being of our families and our community and our society, and all that's going on our planet ecologically, politically, economically, socially, culturally, here on planet Earth. Each week on the show, I talk with different experts and thought leaders about all the different facets of our interconnected world. Today, we'll be talking with Mark D. Cohn, who's a longstanding permaculturalist, landscape designer, wildlife biology scientist, as well as an ongoing inspector for the organic farming food movement. And I'm sure I'm leaving out about a dozen things that Mark can tell us about. This is actually a part two of an earlier program we had discussing some of the fundamentals, and we're going to do a deep dive today into how managing carbon in the landscape, and of course there are many different landscapes here on planet Earth, is really one of the best roadways to managing our ecological destabilization and out-of-control climate problems that we're now occurring and seeing ever more rapidly evolving or devolving, I guess we should say. So happy to have this conversation today, and welcome back to Connect the Dots, Mark D. Cohn.
Thanks, Allison, and thank you for the opportunity to continue the conversation where we left off, because I think we got a pretty good start at a lot of the background of leading up to today. And I think that for people who haven't listened to the first one, probably best to do that. But for now, we're really talking about our relationship to carbon. And I believe that that's really largely where most of the issues are centered. And I'd like to get to a couple generalized models of how the specific landscapes would be looking or how they would be changing in regard to drawing that carbon down from the atmosphere, where it's doing us very little good, just to put it lightly, and where it can be put in the system, particularly soils and landscape architecture, that serves the habitats of living things in a far better way. So that's the general territory I'd like to talk about, and then show how the landscapes not only change, but the process of changing them is going to give us pretty much all of the major things that we need for our livelihoods. So I guess we'll start with a look at forests and forest ecology. Because I think that's a big piece that surrounds most of what most of the human habitats, or within some of the human habitats. I look at organic farms all over the country, and most of the organic farms I visit have at least some forest in them. So the background of this, I think, goes to pre-European North American ecologies, and particularly the indigenous population management of forests using control burns and frequent control burns. So they were light fires that opened up the forest, reduced the fuel load in the forest, unlike the fire suppression that leads to a lot of fuel loads that, you know, create real danger in much hotter fires. So what we're really talking about here is reducing fuel loads, decreasing competition between trees. Most of the modern forests are very choked, and they're competing, and they're lower productivity generally on nut production and things like that in terms of a wildlife capacities.
What is a fuel load? That's for listeners who may not be familiar with that term.
Yeah, so a lot of material that builds up at the forest floor and becomes fuel for a wildfire to burn in a much hotter way. And that fuel load can be kind of strung up into the canopy a bit, and kind of what they call fuel ladders that catch fire and then burn up into the canopy. So by reducing that, and I guess what I'm promoting here is some thinking that I've done over a period of time and spoken with some people who had been trained in indigenous fire management and simultaneously had a PhD in evolutionary ecology in the same education, which is really unusual, and that's how I came to think about it this way. A friend of mine named Dennis Martinez in Northern California, Oregon, on the West Coast. But the reality is that fire was used all over North America, Central, South America, Australia, Europe, by indigenous peoples going all the way back. So this is not a new concept. I'm also working with medicinal plant growing, and here's where the opportunity starts to look interesting to me. If you look at a forest going from, a bare field growing into a forest through successional stages of young growth into medium growth into more mature growth, the carbon uptake curve goes up, 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 and it gets to this place where a lot of our forests are now, where there's too much competition and so forth that I just mentioned. And the carbon uptake of that forest actually starts to slow down the carbon sequestration. So the sweet spot is right there, in my opinion, where strategic thinning of that forest can yield the usual products, like some lumber, some mushroom logs, and then the tops and things could be used in an energy system. There's some new technology, and I can provide links, but I'm working with a group of people here in Athens, Ohio, that have developed a very interesting combined heat, power, and charcoal system. And I'll talk more about this because it's relevant to the other landscapes as well. So by harvesting that
material... some kind of a energy system, stove, something that will use these wood products that are cut down in the thinning or in the cutting of the treetops that you're describing, and then that would become fuel in some kind of manner for a home or building system. Is that right?
Yes. So what we really need to do here, stepping back for just a minute, is to transition from petroleum-based economy to another type of economy. And I'm proposing that we really look at cellulose as a basis of a carbon economy. And there's a couple really important aspects to this. But just to follow that piece through, when you do the thinning, physical thinning, instead of burning in place like it was done traditionally, of hiring people, creating jobs, harvesting this material that optimizes the forest ecology by strategic harvesting of the material that is the most expendable in terms of future genetic adaptation, but creating diversity in that forested system, mixed age, mixed species stands, in short. By doing this, we'll create this economy by having lumber and things like fence posts and hop poles and mushroom logs, as I mentioned. And then the rest of it would go through a process of gasification that creates electricity, simultaneously creates electricity, hot water, space heat, and is left with charcoal or biochar. And one of the significant pieces of that is that charcoal is a form of carbon that is tremendously durable compared to any other type of carbon that we can find. The other closest piece to it, which is not nearly as durable, is humus or humic compounds that are quite a bit more long-lasting than, say, leaves or manure or, you know, most of other types of organic matter we would imagine. So there's a huge leverage point at that charcoal. We'll talk more about that in a moment. So after having done this, the forest potentially, if it's done right, will begin to sequester carbon at a faster rate, which is all part of our goal, and the forest is left in a more open state underneath, understory, and less competition. What the native peoples were doing were creating this environment so that there would be grasses, forbs, medicinal plants growing between those bigger trees that were much more spread out. It was the selection that they were heading for that created good habitat for a really wide range of animals, because all of the animals that ate acorns and nuts would be optimized by the lack of competition and the increased nut production. But because it's more open, the grasses and forbs would feed the ungulate population, the deer and elk and so forth. And so we're going to increase wildlife habitat, and then we're going to be left with a more open understory system that is really prime for forest farming, for medicinal plant, mushroom cultivation, et cetera. And so the entire environment would be more economically productive with a lot of the products that we need. There's no shortage of people with illnesses for those medicines and so forth. Okay, so that's one piece of it. And I guess I'll just go into this one example. There are different scales of this type of technology emerging, but what I'm describing is a carbon-negative renewable energy. And, I mean, carbon-negative in the sense that it's pulling carbon out of the atmosphere. It's carbon-positive in the sense of the landscape increasing in carbon. And one of the...
How does pulling the landscape increase the carbon that the landscape is holding?
So the forest, in this case, we'll talk about pastures and grasslands and also agricultural landscapes, which would include, you know, our yards and gardens and anywhere with soil. But the way it becomes carbon negative is that it very cleanly burns the hydrogen and oxygen away from the cellulose and leaves a carbon skeleton that's incredibly durable, as I mentioned. We're talking probably between 1 and 8,000 years of service in the soil that is much like a coral reef in the sense of the incredible amount of surface area in this material, possibly as much as a football field of surface area in a tablespoon. And that becomes a habitat for microbes and fungi, but also connection points for anions and cations or almost anything that's floating loose in that environment that it will hold. For example, the nitrogen phosphorus issues in a lot of the waterways and the dead zones in Lake Erie and off of the coast of New Orleans, that if it was used at a point source at the first stream from the first farm before it ever ran off into the first real major waterway, those nutrients would be able to be used on those same farms that are buying in nitrogen and phosphorus, right? So we're really talking about reconnecting lots of broken loops here at the same time. But following through on this energy system, and I'm working with these folks, it's up and running. The beta units of them are going out probably within about 3 months. And it's something that I have been watching for quite some time and hoped it would eventually happen in my lifetime. So I'm very pleased that this is up and working, because it's an amazing thing to be able to get all those. I mean, the gravity of this is that if we look at coal and nuclear and most of these other centralized power generating systems, they produce very unfortunate side effects in the form of CO2, things like mountaintop removal and radioactive isotopes and tar sands, landscapes that look like the moon and are basically taken out of biological production, if you've been to any of these sites, and replaces it with healthy landscapes. And for every, so we eventually get into the use of the charcoal, but let's follow this through. So we're going to basically take either wood chips from that excess woody material or wood pellets and run them through a gasification process that runs a Stirling engine that is cooled with water, makes a continuous kilowatt of electricity. Now, these are small-scale systems, so since I live off the grid and have watched 37 winters now where electricity and hot water coming from solar energy is very challenging getting through the winter. So this fills that gap really nicely and gives any off-grid home all the power, hot water, and space heat that you're going to need, and particularly if it's integrated into a growing system, a greenhouse, you're getting into very interesting overall footprint, because when you track it out, every kilowatt of electricity this thing is producing is displacing a kilowatt of electricity generated with all those impacts I just mentioned. It's also displacing the energy to heat water, usually gas, usually coming from fracking operations. And it's displacing the whatever fuel oil or electric heat, again, going back to the, you know, it all comes from somewhere. It's getting a lot done. Even if you're burning a wood stove, you're taking that same wood and you're getting all these other functions out of it. So the real beauty of this is that it leaves 17% of that wood chip or wood pellet in the form of biochar, which has, as I just mentioned, probably thousands of years of durability in the soil. And we can, if we have time, we can talk about many other uses of this this charcoal. But for right now, we'll just talk about the soil aspects.
I just want before we go into that, I just wanted to kind of just take a step back for listeners and say, you know, what we're talking about here is a household design system that, instead of being in a situation where, in order to maintain one's home, whatever it is, any type of home, in fact, is then feeding in to these larger problems that are destroying our climate and the earth. And so this is a model, and, you know, over many years, 37 years or more counting, what you're discussing is perfecting a model that doesn't have any gaps, that actually, has no sort of shortfalls, or yes, this part of it works, but it's not entirely seamless, and then instead we need to do this. You know, it's kind of like a total model for, you know, a human household of some kind, as, you know, one of the building blocks of everything, you know, of our way of managing our lives. And so if you have that model, then theoretically, potentially, more people, maybe not universally in the first moment, but could be adapting to a better model that is more earth-friendly. So just, you know, want to say that's what we're talking about here. You know, so that listeners can kind of understand, like, why some of these ingenious developments, you know, are filling important gaps in answering the question, you know, how do we withdraw and reinvest our infrastructures, you know, from the smallest scale, from fossil fuel. Okay, just had to say that.
Yes. What I will say along those lines is that there are much larger versions of this technology that are emerging.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like what I'm talking about is limited to this small scale system. It's just that the way that I personally live is wired to being very self-reliant and exciting to me. The other ones are exciting too. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people can't burn wood, and it, even though it's cleaner than the cleanest wood stove, it's just not practical. And so for those kinds of systems, we do have much larger versions that can be done at a power plant level. Or
wow.
Say the one example I'm looking at, which can make lots of electricity, or can make synthetic diesel fuel as a byproduct of transforming that woody material to charcoal. Again, with the long-term carbon storage aspects of it. So something to understand is that solar and wind renewable energy, at the very best, is going to be carbon neutral. You're not really getting much done from pulling all that tremendous amount of carbon that's in the atmosphere down to where it's going to serve living things better at the soil and landscape level. So one of the things that it does when you get that biochar into the soil, you have to charge it. You've got to fill all those. It's like a hungry sponge or a battery, and so you have to charge that battery with minerals and biology to be able to get it into the soil. But once you do, on top of all of the other aspects, it for every one percentage point of organic matter in the soil, whether that's biochar, and we'll get into some of the other ways. So the charcoal is kind of like a icing on the cake after you've done everything else right, hopefully. But one percentage point of organic matter is equivalent to about 28,000 gallons of water storage per acre. This starts becoming really important in the hot, dry conditions, which are coming. They're already here for a lot of people, but it's going to be something we can kind of bank on. It's not just going that direction. It's going in all the extremes. But I feel like when you look at the growing seasons, other than hail and, you know, floods, the hot, dry conditions are going to be one of the things that limit our food supply. And so what I'll be talking about a lot are specific landscape level changes that have lots of value to the changes, but one of them will be climate mitigation and adaptation.
So when you say, for example, that solar and wind are carbon neutral, that means we're not adding carbon when we do those. We have stopped the fuel activities that are adding carbon. But what you're now talking about and these developments that you're describing are actually taking carbon down. So they are actually mitigating and sucking the carbon that is heating our world back into the earth and into the landscape. And so that goes while also supplying, you know, what is needed to heat or cool or, you know, kind of heat water or whatever, grow plants. So it's actually, it's a huge, you know, it's potentially, if applied widely, a very important mitigation effect. And that's what we're talking about when we say carbon neutral versus carbon, you know, subtractive, just
negative.
Reiterating that point. Mm-hmm.
Right.
So that's
and
really important.
Think,
mm-hmm.
Yes, very important. And it's left out of most of the conversations that I'm hearing. You know, it seems like when we look at the really destructive status quo, moving from that to solar and wind looks incredible. And it
mm-hmm.
is, but it's only carbon negative. When I say at best, it's, you know, that would have to be probably manufactured, that the parts were being manufactured with solar and wind energy and probably driven around in an electric vehicle to get them to place, because when you really do the accounting, it probably isn't even carbon neutral. And there's it's complicated to even, you know, to fully measure all of the work. You can get the thing that the model I mentioned wrong in lots of ways. But I think that the real leverage point is this tremendous period of time that the carbon is staying in the soil and what it's doing for fertility and water holding and all the other functions of it. you know, so you have to source those feedstocks really properly to get it right, and then you have to account for the energy that it took to harvest them and the carbon that was burned when you made the charcoal, even though you did get electricity and hot water and so forth. You know, there's a lot of accounting there to do, but it's going to be carbon negative if you do it right. To the exact degree, I'm not sure, but to have any renewable energy that is carbon negative is incredibly impressive from what I'm seeing.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't we go to the next piece, and we could always loop back, but the next piece is, if you look at our agricultural landscapes, they're largely made up of pasture, grassland-type systems, and agricultural cropping systems, more as we know it. And within those, you do have, orchards and tree systems or perennial agriculture. Now, with those hot, dry climates that are already coming, and we're going to definitely see more, according to every climate analyst out there that I've heard, those landscapes are very vulnerable if they don't have trees. Now, in the first part of this, I talked about my experience in the tropics, and it's kind of interesting that, you know, in the tropical sun, it's easier to understand why we need shade. In the temperate zone, it seems like you can get by with, you know, open grasslands or wide open cropping systems. But those systems are going to be very vulnerable as the temperature goes up and the soils are more eroded. So we're down to probably the last 25% of our soils. The organic matter, as I mentioned, every point holds 28,000 gallons of water. Just about all the agricultural land used to be much higher in organic matter previously. So we've been slowly wearing down that natural capital. And if you plant in the right trees into, say, let's say pasture systems for starters, grasslands, and you begin to kind of mimic some of the ecosystems out there, like in the Serengeti, which got the highest animal migration on Earth, and it's an integration of grasses and trees, nitrogen-fixing trees. We can do something very similar to that in integrating silvopastoral systems, basically agroforestry, one of the agroforestry strategies. And in doing so, on those hot, dry days when the animals normally, if you've driven around, I get to see a lot of farms, and so on a 90 or 95 degree day that where it hasn't rained in 3 weeks, those pastures are turning brown very often, and the animals mm-hmm. are laying, panting somewhere, trying to find shade. On a farm that had trees planted in the proper manner, those animals would be grazing all day long in the hot sun, and be productive economically, food-wise, regardless of the type of animal. And so that again brings you to this point where those trees, when they mature, can be harvested actually more easily than a lot of the woodland landscapes because you can plant them in rows and then thin them or coppice them, which means to cut them off. And certain species, when you cut them off at the ground, they resprout. And you can mm-hmm. manage those continuously resprouting and harvest them in a smaller size that are easier to run through a chipper or whatever method you're going to prepare them for these energy systems. So you're starting to get lots of functions again. And if you put that biochar back into those soils underneath of them, they're going to be holding more water. They're going to take longer to dry out than just with trees, which would also take longer to dry out than no trees and no biochar. But the other significant thing to this part of the picture is that intensive rotational grazing of livestock on pastures, if you diversify the species in that pasture and you move them properly with the proper densities of animals per acre, you can get incredible carbon sequestration in those. I actually saw one last maybe 4 months ago that I was absolutely blown away by. It was only about an hour from where I live. But this was a 400-acre piece of property that had, it was a beef operation that was doing nothing more than moving those cows with into different paddocks at the right timing. We don't have enough time to go into the real nuts and bolts of that, and most people listening may not be interested in grazing. But the point is that I looked at his soil test, which I often do on my organic inspections, and in as little as 4 years, they were able to increase the organic matter in those soils by 3 percentage points, which is unbelievable, really. And the inputs were really nothing more than electric fencing, which can be done easily with solar panels, and then people to move those animals at the right rates, as I mentioned. So you're getting 3 percentage points in 4 years. That's far beyond what was identified in the Paris Accords climate agreement. And then you have this other aspect. So you've got the reason why it's being done for, in this case, beef. It could be dairy. The dairy farms that I've seen have not increased carbon that much, but you still can build very nice soil with the right kind of management. So you have the manure, you've got the grazing, you've got the increase in the carbon that's happening there, plus you've got the trees above it, which can be fixing nitrogen in the case of black locust, and it can be coppiced for fence posts, for hop poles, for fuel, and the energy system I mentioned. This is a very productive landscape and there's going to be limits to what any landscape can take in terms of climate variation, but this is going to take us way down the road for systems that would have been failing otherwise. So we're literally hydrating these landscapes, and it goes along with, in all of these systems, go along with other management systems that catch water. So a whole series of pond building, whales. There's a system in Australia that was developed called Key Line Agriculture. Again, would take a little more time than we have today, but worth looking into for anybody who wants to read about it. And so we're talking about really making these landscapes resilient and productive in a changing climate.
So what we really now have is a situation where we have been, pushing the landscape in various ways to supply, and now pushing in all those capacities has had this congruent, kind of harmful effect on the entire ecology and climate of the planet. And now most people listening to this show are probably not as in touch with, certainly not as in touch with the diverse landscapes of the Earth as you are. But there are different kinds of landscapes that we're talking about on this show that are failing, that are non-optimized, that are vulnerable to extreme disruptions as climate progresses. And so as we consider each of these different kinds of landscapes, and it's certainly not that an individual necessarily will run out and do this on their own, although we can discuss some things that, the average person might do. But it's really more about how we have to have a conscious relationship with the landscapes of Earth so that we do not, they're not just all precipitously declining and failing due to our misuse, but we're, as you know, what you're describing is ways that you and others have identified to actually support them and recreate them and regenerate them so that they function, we can both have stable habitats as well as food and water and other things that we need through the battering that the, you know, these different landscapes and the earth itself, which is, you know, all of them together, will take with this climate disruption. So, I mean, what we're talking about here is that there are ways, and it's really incredibly fortunate that these ways have been developed because they provide an, you know, an opportunity to protect lands, in protecting landscapes of the earth, whether, you know, we're protecting our own habitat rather than, you know, kind of merely dealing with, you know, the horrible aftermath of not protecting it. And it's really quite ingenious and wonderful that unbeknownst to the average person, all over the world, people have been looking at this and have, you know, been, as you're describing, refining these different interactive methodologies.
Yes, I would say that we are all going to go out and do something, and that is either directly the thing I'm talking about or at least beginning to source our purchasing decisions toward the people who are going to be doing it. You know, in other words, we're all going to be buying, we're all going to be buying products that come from landscapes, and I think it's it's our responsibility to become conscious of how that's being done, whether it's being done by ourselves or by someone we're supporting. We need to get in touch with that. So this is something everybody can do. This isn't something that a few people, even if they wanted to, could do. It's going to be a really distributed process. So that being said, the other piece of this, and now I'm also talking about, I'm generalizing these three zones, but there's a lot of other types of aspects of the landscape, and part of this strategy is definitely, I'll just give a couple quick examples, all the riparian zones, or the areas along streams and rivers, should be turned into diversified, vegetated, shaded systems. And there's a lot of landscapes in cities that need to be considered as well. We need to have tree planting to shade the asphalt and cement and buildings as much as is possible, because they're all very rapidly gathering heat. And part of the overall story has, it's not just carbon sequestration, it is really looking at the way water occupies landscapes and the atmosphere, and looking at the different places where water exists. So it obviously in the oceans and in the rivers and lakes, but also in the soil and in the plants. And this all really matters when you look at climate and creating microclimates and altering warming and cooling trends and so forth. Another topic for another day to really go into detail in that. But what I will do, so we make sure we don't run out of time, is to talk about the agriculture sector for a moment. And there's a number of opportunities here. One of them is very similar to the pasture system in that open agricultural landscapes are inherently more vulnerable than ones with integrated perennials, with deeper root systems and shade and nitrogen fixation and all sorts of connected ecological relationships with this larger ecosystem. And so strategic planting in the form of alley cropping, agroforestry, those types of systems, and again, on top of ideally really good agroecological management, meaning keeping some type of green cover on the landscape all year long, as much as is possible, depending on how far north you are. But even then, there are some pretty hardy cover crops. So winter cover cropping, green manure crops, which are cover crops that get turned under for soil building and preparation for the next crop. These have really strong ecological implications, because what's been emerging lately, particularly with the work of Dr. Christine Jones in Australia and others, is we're coming into a better understanding of the liquid carbon pathway in the soil, which is that part of the photosynthetic energy that the plant gathers is exuded out through that plant, through the roots into the soil, and feeds the bacterial and fungal communities that support them. And so this becomes a really big part of that carbon story, is having healthy plants, not struggling plants. They can't produce as much. But healthy plants, green as much of the year as possible, is a really strong base to then build on with some of these techniques like using biochar and such. But the other thing about trees and creating these more shaded, a little bit of shade, a little bit of windbreak, and pretty soon you've got a microclimate that's survivable by a wider diversity of plants and then all the animals that they support, you're really talking about increasing the overall capacity of that landscape to support life. And I think we have a long way to go to optimize that. That's a good thing, because we've got a very overpopulated planet that really needs to find leverage points to support not only those people, but all of the animals and species that in the end we require as part of the logic of production of the things we need to create these resilient landscapes that can produce our needs while meeting the needs of all the others. And so it's a tall order, but certainly possible. And I think that the other piece here is all of the what is called waste, which there really shouldn't be a perception of waste if we understand how everything can be utilized. But there's a lot of agricultural waste that can be put through some of these same energy systems with the byproduct of charcoal. And that can then feed back into these systems. For example, if you take agricultural waste and you char it, getting your energy from it, the electricity and heat and so forth, you can take that char and put it in a bedding pack or in a poultry house. I don't know how familiar people are with the way eggs and meat birds are produced, but it's usually fairly large scale buildings, and I'm not really an advocate of that, but in that setting, there's so many, let's say the bird operation, the poultry operation, that there's so many birds that you have a lot of venting and fans and energy required to remove the methane gas that builds up. Mm-hmm. And so by using charcoal, it's incredibly useful for absorbing that methane. And what is that really? It's nitrogen that can be used on the farm. So 1 pound of biochar, of the charred material, can absorb a half a pound of nitrogen. And again, these are things that wind up being pollutants. And methane is far more of a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. So mm-hmm. you're taking the problem, you're turning it into an asset. You'll have mm-hmm. less off-farm expense for nitrogen. So for 25 cents worth of charcoal, you can capture 20 cents worth of nitrogen. That's without getting into all the other nutrients that are being absorbed by that charcoal or the water holding capacity and such. So,
I just want to comment on something concerning this, which is, all along, I've very often in being part of the, we're having a climate problem, fossil fuels are a problem, wake up, which is what I've been doing as a journalist and an advocate for over a decade. which really is a relatively short period of time. But in any case, you know, one of the things that I frequently hear when people are kind of reluctant to face up to the problem is, oh, some technology will come along that is going to, you know, save our ass, basically, excuse my French. And, you know, this is the technology. What you're describing throughout this program is, in fact, the technology that people are hoping will save us. And except that instead of it being a technology of bye-bye planet Earth, we're going to the moon or Mars or wherever, and, you know, we're going to spend a gazillion dollars on some sort of space shot trying to recreate life on another inhospitable planet, you know, these are ways of actually working with, on, for, and, you know, aligned with the planet we actually have. And, you know, in enormously creative ways, but because, you know, you're talking about using natural substances rather than metal wires and and computers, you know, it's like no one thinks of that as being a technology, but in fact, all of this is, I don't know if maybe technology is the right word, but it's an incredibly ingenious and complex, you know, biological solution.
Yes, I don't want to oversimplify it. This is part of the, you know, I think it's about getting an education in the role of carbon in our livelihoods and the relation to water, and look at the critical nature of water in living systems that we know of, and properly understanding the role of soils and making sure that we take care of these processes. We're still going to have other technologies. I mean, we're trying to create the space so that we can continue to do a lot of the other things we're doing that are inherently going to come crashing down if we ignore the carbon part of the story. And so it's getting that part right that I'm mainly talking about. I'm not saying that this is all we need to do. There's a lot of other things involved in health and such. But when you get the soils right, so many of the, well, not just the soils, but the seed, the selection of our seed, the soils, the elements that make our food medicine, which it really is to a large degree when it's all gotten right, and there's a long story to getting it right. But this all plays into that soil component that is such a big part. So, yes, it is kind of technically biotechnology, but it's not transgenic or, you know, manipulated
No.
in a way that requires chemicals. It's more like biomimicry. When
mm-hmm.
you look at biological systems are working really well. They're giving you everything you need to know to design in parallel
mm-hmm.
Rather than feeling like we have to improve on everything. We're kind of missing
mm-hmm.
the point of what's happening out there. You know, you got a lot to live up to try to ever even, you know, come close to, you know, the integrity of what's happening in a lot of these, you know, more mature biological systems. However, there are places that we may be able to accelerate things faster than they would normally ever go. And I think some of these
mm-hmm.
carbon strategies are hitting that. A little bit hard to measure because in a forest where that's got really deep root systems, there's a lot of carbon being sequestered much deeper than we know how to measure. The soil tests I look at the top 6 inches. And so that increase I mentioned was in the top 6 inches. Now, that's a already more vulnerable part of the soil to have carbon because it's going to be more likely to be oxidized than, say, carbon 15 feet down that was, you know, built from tree roots that are very deep. So I'm inherently oversimplifying some elements of this, but you almost have to be able to communicate it in an hour. I'll just say that. But, yes,
mm-hmm.
it's all quite very exciting to that. I mean, for me, having looked at it and been had a fair amount of anxiety about where this is all going, to start seeing that there is there are options here that are really quite impressive and to speak to the very things that we're mostly trying to ignore, but doesn't make them go away. As an ecologist, right. I sort of train my eye to understand things, whether it's good news or bad news, and to try to live with the bad news and figure out ways of solving for them. For that kind of perspective, it's very exciting.
Definitely. Yeah, I think it's exciting. If you understand the implications of where all this, you know, kind of biomimicry or ecological kind of resonance with what the Earth is doing and what we can do to relate creatively and supportively to that. It's more than just saying, we're all on the Earth, I love the Earth, we're all connected, you know, which is what people say because of those feelings being inspired. But that doesn't mean that, you know, everybody either has, knows of, or is even aware that these kinds of ecological skills exist, you know, for the optimization. And so it leads to a feeling of kind of overwhelm or despair. I think it's really important for the average person to understand these possibilities and this way of thinking, whatever depth they're able to go with it, or, you know, however much they're able to support it, enact it, or, you know, go toward it. I mean, it's important for people who can go toward it and maybe learn and master it and enact some of this. It's important for people to know some basic things they can do, but it's equally important, you know, to understand that these are the basic principles for supporting survival of all species on Earth, which, you know, if we had to wish for, you know, anything of all the many things that, you know, humans wish for, that would certainly seem to be, you know, a paramount goal or direction we would like things to go in. So I think all of this is very important because it represents a branch of bioecological knowledge that can be extremely helpful. So we need to know that that exists, and, you know, we need to support the people doing it and participate in whatever way we can if this is something we care about, which I think many people do care about it.
I agree. I think there's very few people that don't care, and I think that, that understanding it gives us the ability to have a choice in how we're connected. Yes, we are connected. Mm-hmm. There's no question about that. But how are we connected? Are we connected through human causation of mass extinction, or are we connected through restoring the integrity of landscapes that can support a higher amount of life because we're there, not because we're not there? And so I think the understanding it part gives us the tools to then make choices to get our relationships where we really want them. Otherwise, we're kind of deluding ourselves, I think, that somehow it's all going to be okay and somebody else is going to come up with some magical you know, solutions technologically. I don't believe it's going to happen anything remotely that way. I think we're actually seeing the opposite of that. And so the lack of participation in conscious stewardship or conscious restoration of systems is leaving it in the hands of smaller and smaller numbers of people to make those decisions, and those people are more interested in profit than they are in the restoration. And so very poor decisions get made when you put all the eggs in one basket and then, you know, incentivize profit around things like human illness and warfare and so forth. These become incentivized through profit. So I think the way that the solutions work best, as far as I can tell, is when you've got a really large number of people in the society participating consciously and physically.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think, you know, as we're in this, you know, politically devolutionary cycle where avenues of efficacy that had existed before and that people took for granted or devolving, you know, there's an important opportunity to find new pathways and evolve those. And, you know, and without a doubt, you know, this is a very important one. We're coming down to, you know, the last several minutes of the show. So, you know, I want to thank you very much, Mark D. Cohen, for coming back and kind of closing this portion of the loop with our listeners. And, you know, there's obviously more to be probed and shared and understood as well in future episodes of Connect the Dots. And, you know, it's really, you know, having, you know, kind of repeatedly kind of roused people to understand the causative level, you know, of so many of these problems. It's terrific to contemplate the potential and need for this kind of restoration that we can participate, all can participate in different ways. Maybe we'll do a future show about the variety of ways that people can participate from wherever they are, and as well as going forward. So I just want to thank you again for, you know, joining us on today's Connect the Dots.
You're very welcome.
And thank you to you listeners, too, for staying with us as we go over this new and fascinating terrain. We've been doing a number of shows on regenerative agriculture over the last year. Please go to the archives. You can find the earlier program that Mark was talking about. We recently did a show on water cycles with Judith C. Schwartz. And we've got a program with Fred Kirschenman last summer, and we've interviewed, you know, quite a number of different experts in this area, and we're going to be continuing to develop this topic because other than that, you know, we're going to be doing, we would be doing programs on Ivanka and the Russians, and I just really don't want to do that. So thank you for being with us every week on Connect the Dots. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Be well, heads up, and keep marching forward with all our relations.
Well,